So now we move away from the perceptual side of things to consider the statistical properties of sound. You know, the sound of wind differs from the sound of a babbling brook. These are not formants. It's not a deterministic signal, which a lot of us deal with in terms of speech. So how do you recognize the statistical behavior of a sound? Dan Ellis at Columbia and Josh McDermott at NYU will describe their sound texture representation and talk about its use in sound classification. Welcome, Josh.
All right. Thanks, Malcolm. And thanks, everybody, for showing up to our session. So like Malcolm said, I'm going to talk about texture today. And textures are sounds that result from large numbers of acoustic events. And they include things that you hear all the time, like the sound of rain, wind, birds, running water, insects, crowd noise, applause, and fire. So these kinds of sounds are common in the world, and it seems likely that they're important for a lot of tasks that humans have to perform and that we might want to get machines to perform, like figuring out where you are or what the weather is like, for instance. But in contrast to the vast literature on visual texture, both in human and machine vision, sound textures are largely unstudied. So the question that we've been looking into is how can textures be represented and recognized? There is some previous work on modeling sound texture. This is probably not a completely exhaustive list of the publications, but it's certainly a big chunk of them. So it's a pretty small literature. There's also, of course, a lot of work on environmental sounds that's often inclusive of texture. And the work that I'm going to be talking about differs a little bit from these approaches in that our perspective is that machine recognition might be able to get some clues from human texture perception. And so in this sense, this is very much in the spirit of the work that Nima talked about and what Dick was just talking about before me. So we've been looking into how humans represent and recognize textures. And the starting point for the work is the observation that unlike the sounds that are made by individual events, like a spoken word, textures are stationary, so their essential properties don't change over time, and that's sort of one of their defining properties. So whereas the waveform of a word here clearly has a beginning and an end and a temporal evolution, the sound of rain is just kind of there, right? So the qualities that make it rain don't change over time. And so the key proposal is that because they're stationary, textures can be captured by statistics that are just time averages of acoustic measurements. If the thing doesn't change, we can just make some measurements, average them over time, and that ought to do a good job of capturing its qualities. So what we propose is that when you recognize the sound of fire or the sound of rain, you're recognizing these summary statistics. And whatever statistics you and your auditory system are measuring are presumably derived from peripheral auditory representations that we know something about. And you've heard a bit about this in the first two talks. So we know that sound is filtered by the cochlea, and you can think of the output of the cochlea as sort of a subband type representation. We know that a lot of the information in subbands is conveyed by their amplitude envelopes after they've been compressed by the cochlea. And there's now quite a bit of evidence that the envelopes or the spectrogram-like representation that they comprise are then subsequently filtered by another stage of filters that are often called modulation filters. And so the things that Nima was showing, those receptive fields of cortical neurons, are like this, although he was showing examples from the cortex where the tuning is a little bit more complicated and you see patterns in both frequency and time. The modulation filters that we typically look at are those that mimic the things that you find subcortically in the inferior colliculus and thalamus, where things are primarily tuned for temporal modulation. So these little things here represent the passband in temporal modulation frequency. So the question that we've been looking into is how much of texture perception can be captured with relatively simple summary statistics of representations like these that we believe to be present in biological auditory systems, and whether these summary statistics would then be useful for machine recognition tasks. So the methodological proposal that underlies most of the work is that synthesis is a very powerful way to test a perceptual theory. And the notion is that if your brain represents sounds with some set of measurements, like statistics, then signals that have the same values of those measurements ought to sound the same to you. And in particular, sounds that we synthesize to have the same measurements as some real-world recording ought to sound like another example of the same kind of thing if the measurements that we use to do the synthesis are like the ones that the brain uses to represent sound. And so we've been taking this approach with sound texture perception, synthesizing textures from statistics measured in real-world sounds. So the basic idea is to take some example signal, like a recording of rain, measure some statistics, and then synthesize new signals, constraining them only to have those same statistics, and in other respects, making them as random as possible. And the approach that we've taken here is very much inspired by work that was done quite a while back on visual texture synthesis, some of the authors of which are mentioned here. So I'm just going to give you a very simple toy example to just illustrate the logic. Let's suppose that we wanted to test the role of the power spectrum. You might think that power spectrum plays some role in texture. So what we'd do is we'd measure the spectrum of some real-world texture like this. Now we just want to synthesize a random signal with the same spectrum. Well, obviously this is really easy. We just filter noise, and then we listen to them and see what they sound like. And unfortunately for advocates of the power spectrum theory of texture, things generally sound like noise when you do this. So it doesn't sound like rain, it sounds like noise. And as opposed to this. All right, so the synthesis is not realistic, and this tells us that we're not simply registering the spectrum when we recognize textures. All right, so the question is, will additional simple statistics do any better? And so we've been mostly looking at statistics of these two stages of representations, the envelopes of subbands and the modulation bands that you can derive from them with simple linear filters. And we've looked into how far we can get with very simple statistics, things like marginal moments, like the variance and the skew and the kurtosis in addition to the mean, as well as pairwise correlations between different pieces of the representation, for instance, different envelopes or different subbands or different modulation bands. So these statistics are generic. They're not tailored to any specific natural sound, but they are simple and they're easy to measure. On the other hand, because of this, it's not obvious that they would account for much of sound recognition, but maybe they're a reasonable place to start. Now, for these statistics to have any hope of being useful for recognition, well, at a minimum, they have to yield different values for different types of sounds. And so what I'm going to quickly do is just give you a couple of examples to give you some intuition for what kinds of things these might capture. So let's quickly look at some of the marginal moments of cochlear envelopes, the envelopes of cochlear subbands. So these moments, again, things like the mean and the variance and the skew, are statistics that describe how the envelope is distributed. So you take a stripe of a cochlear spectrogram, you take the envelope, collapse that across time to give you a histogram that gives you the frequency of occurrence of different amplitudes. And this is a very simple sort of representation of sound, but as many of you will know, these kinds of amplitude distributions generally differ for natural sounds than for noise, and they vary between different kinds of natural sounds. So here's just a quick example. These are amplitude histograms for noise, recording of a stream, and recording of geese from one particular channel. And the thing to note here is that although these distributions have about the same mean, indicating that there's roughly the same acoustic power in this channel, the distributions have different shapes. And you can also see this visually if you just look at the spectrograms. So you can see that the pink noise here is mostly gray, whereas the stream and the geese have got more black and white. And so in this case, the white would be down here, and the black would be up here. So they deviate more from the mean, with more high amplitudes and more low amplitudes. So many of you will probably recognize that this is an indication of the common observation that natural signals are sparser than noise. So the intuition is that natural sounds contain events like raindrops and geese calls, and these events are infrequent, but when they occur, they produce large amplitudes. And when they don't occur, the amplitude tends to be low. And this sparsity behavior, which alters the shape of these histograms, is reflected in pretty simple statistics like the variance, which measures the spread of the distribution, and the skew, which measures the asymmetry about the mean. All right, so one more example. Let's take a quick look at what kind of correlations we can observe between envelopes of different channels. And these things also vary across sounds, and one of the main reasons for this is the presence of broadband events. So if you listen to the sound of fire, fire's got lots of crackles and pops and clicks, and those crackles and pops are visible in the spectrogram as these vertical streaks. So these broadband events induce dependencies between channels because they excite them all at once, and you can see this if you look at correlations between channels. So this is just a big matrix of correlation coefficients between pairs of cochlear filters going from low frequency to high and low to high. So the diagonal here has got to be 1, but the off diagonals can be whatever, and you can see that for fire there's a lot of yellow and a lot of red, indicating that there's correlations between channels. And not all sounds are like this. Here's a stream, and you can see that there's mostly green here. Well, it looks yellow on this screen, but trust me, it's green. And that's because for a lot of water sounds, the different channels are mostly uncorrelated. Okay, so these statistics, although they're simple, they capture variation across sound. And the question we're trying to get at is whether they actually capture the sound of real-world textures. So again, the strategy is to synthesize a signal constrained only to have the same statistics as some real-world sound, but in other respects being as random as possible. And the way we do that is by starting with a noise signal and then adjusting the noise signal to get it to have the desired statistics, turning it into some new signal. So the basic idea is to filter the noise with the same set of filters giving you a subband representation, and then to adjust the subband envelopes via gradient descent to cause them to have the desired statistical properties. And so the statistics are just functions of the envelope. We can compute their gradient and then change the envelope in the gradient direction until we get the desired statistics. So that gives us new subbands, and then we add them back up to get a new sound signal, which we can listen to. So here's just a flow chart. I won't give you all the details here, but the basic strategy is to first measure the statistics of a real-world sound texture after processing it in the auditory model, and then processing a noise signal in the same way and altering its envelopes to give it the same statistics. And there's an iterative process that you have to do to get this to converge. But the end result is a sound signal that shares the statistics of a real-world sound. So the question is, how do they sound? So we're asking this question again because if the statistics account for texture perception, well, then the synthetic signal should sound like new examples of the real thing. And interestingly, in many cases, they do. So I'm going to play you a sequence of synthetic sounds that are just generated from noise by forcing the noise to have some of the same statistics as various real-world sounds. And so you get things that sound like rain, streams, bubbles, fire, applause, wind, insects, birds, and crowd noise. So it also works for a lot of unnatural sounds, things like rustling paper or a jackhammer. All right, so the success of the synthesis suggests that these statistics could underlie the representation and recognition of textures. So we did a quick experiment to see whether this was true in human listeners. People were presented with a 5-second sound clip and had to identify it from 5 choices. So chance performance here is 20%. And we presented them with synthetic signals that were synthesized with different numbers of statistical constraints, as well as the originals. And you can see here that when we just match the power spectrum, people are above chance but not very good. But the performance improves as we add in more statistics until with a full set of the model that I showed you previously, you're almost as good as with the originals. So this illustrates that these simple statistics can, in fact, support recognition of real-world textures. Another point that's just worth quickly mentioning is that the synthesis here is not simply reproducing the original waveform. So because the procedure is initialized with noise, it churns out a different sound signal every time that share only the statistical properties. And these are just 3 examples of waves that were synthesized from a single set of statistics measured in a single recording. And you get a very different thing each time, and you can make as many of these as you want. So the statistics are really capturing some more abstract property of the sound signal. All right, so another interesting question is whether these texture statistics that seem to be implicated in human texture perception will also be useful for machine recognition. And at present, we don't really have an ideal task with which to test this because we need lots and lots of labeled textures. And if any of you have those, I'd be interested to get them. But Dan Ellis had an idea that an interesting potential application for this might be video soundtrack classification. So as everybody knows, there's lots of interest these days in being able to search for video clips depending on their content. And Dan got his hands on a data set courtesy of a colleague at Columbia, Yugang Jiang, where Yugang had a bunch of people view video clips in an interface like this. So they would watch something like this, and then they would hear something like this. Whoa. Something's funny here. PowerPoint, you gotta love it. All right, so that was the soundtrack. And then they would look at this thing and they'd have to check all the boxes that applied. And so some of these things are attributes. You probably can't see them in the back, but some of them are attributes of the video. Others describe the audio. And so this case, the person has checked cheering and clapping. They said this was outdoor in a rural environment. So there's a whole bunch of labels that get attached to each of these videos. And so the idea is that the texture statistics can be used as features for SVM classifications. You can train up SVMs to recognize these particular labels and distinguish them from others. In order for this to work, of course, the statistics have to give you different values for different labels. And what this plot shows is just the average values of the different statistics for the different labels in the set. So the labels are going on the vertical axis, and the different statistics are on the horizontal axis. And the point here is just that as you scan down the columns, the color changes. Right? So the different labels are, on average, associated with different statistics. And so we find that you can do some degree of classification with these statistics. This is the average performance across all of the categories, which is overall modest. But one of the things to point out here is that you see a pattern that's qualitatively like what you see in the human observers. That is, performance is not that great when you just match the mean value of the envelopes, that is the spectrum, but it gets better as you add in more statistics. Some labels get categories better than others, so speech and music are pretty easy, as a lot of you probably know. I'm showing them here in part to show that the pattern that you get is a little bit different for different categories. So for music, for instance, the modulation power in the modulation band seems to matter a lot. You get a benefit in classification there, whereas for speech, the cross-band correlations that measure things like co-modulation is more important. Performance is poor for some of the labels, I think in part because they're acoustically heterogeneous. That is, they're just not really well-suited to the representation we have. So one of the labels is urban, and you can imagine that that consists of like a lot of different kinds of sound textures. And so the statistics are not great there. So it's not really the ideal task. It's sort of just more of a proof of concept. And I think to really use these statistics for classifying semantic categories like this, like urban, you probably have to first recognize particular textures like traffic or crowd noise, and then link those labels to categories. So take-home messages here. The first thing is just that textures are ubiquitous and I think important and worth studying, and I think they may involve a unique form of representation relative to other kinds of auditory phenomena, namely summary statistics. And so we find that naturalistic textures can be generated from relatively simple summary statistics of early auditory representations, marginal moments, and pairwise correlations of cochlear and modulation filters. And the suggestion is that listeners are using similar statistics to recognize sound textures. So when you remember the sound of fire or the sound of rain, we think you're just remembering some of these summary statistics. And the suggestion is that similar statistics should be useful for machine recognition of textures, and that's something that we'll continue to explore. Thanks.
Thanks, Josh. Questions? I have one question. Do you expect the same kind of statistics to be useful in recognizing speech or other deterministic signals? Or is it different, something in between, or something completely different?
Yeah, so I think one interesting notion is that so texture is a thing that's stationary, right? And so it makes sense to compute these summary statistics where you're averaging things over the length of the signal. For signals where you're interested in the non-stationary structure, what you might want to do is compute those statistics but averaged over local time windows so that the statistics would give you sort of a trajectory over time of the way that the local structure changes. And so there's a lot of sounds that kind of locally are texture-like, but they have some kind of temporal evolution. When you get into bed, like the sound that you make as you kind of go over the sheets and everything's rustling, those are different textures, but they're sort of sequenced in like a particular way. And I don't know how useful that would be for something like speech, but certainly for, I think, some kinds of non-stationary sounds, that sort of approach of looking at the temporal evolution of the texture statistics may be useful.
Microphone here.
How would this extend if you had mixtures of textures? In other words, a baseball game where it's raining.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm very interested in this, and I think that what you might need to do is actually before, so all of these statistics, like I said, they're time averages, right? So like the correlation is an average of a product, right, or whatever. The variance is the average of a deviation. And before you do the time average, what you might need to do is do some kind of clustering. Because, for instance, in the case of, let's say you have, wind, which isn't really very correlated across channels, and like clapping that is, right? So you're going to have sort of a mixture of these two very different kinds of events, some of which will be close to 100% correlated, and others of which will not. And so if you just combine those, you're going to get a correlation of 0.5, which is not really a good representation.
You can have a joint statistics across any join higher order statistics.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll be finally a use for higher order spectrum, higher accumulants and stuff across frequency bands here.
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting problem. And I mean, it is related to some of the ways that people are thinking about sound segregation in terms of clustering. And so you may have to do some kind of segregation really in order to model that. There are cases where it works, but cases where it doesn't, yeah.
Okay.
Hi, I just have a quick question. For all your experiments, especially the subjective classification, what was the sampling rate of the audio clips you used?
What was the sampling rate of the sound signals?
Yeah.
Probably 20K. Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I mean the envelopes. You know, the statistics are computed on envelopes, and of course those are low pass things, right? So they have an effective sampling rate of something much lower, like you know a few hundred hertz. But that's right. The actual sound files have you know pretty high normal sampling rate. Yeah.
Did you check to see the effect of the accuracy of your statistical measurements, especially by the length of the data that you analyzed? Because higher order statistics really start failing when the length gets shorter.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's a great question.
How long were your files that you analyzed?
So I standardly work with pretty long things, like 5 seconds, but I have looked at things shorter, and the most of the statistics are robust down to pretty short lengths. So when you start measuring things like kurtosis and stuff, then it gets a bit less robust. But that's actually not that important for the synthesis.
Not for you, right?
Yeah. Well, the kurtosis of the envelope.
Right.
So yeah, the variance kind of does most of the work there, okay. And the correlations and stuff.
How far did you go in the order statistics?
Nothing more than kurtosis. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
So it looks like the way the approach you are taking is based on non-parametric. Method where you collect all the summary statistics up to any whatever order you want to have. Now, have you ever considered using any parametric method that actually may fit all this observation, you know, whatever features, original features you get, and from that you can extract additional, you know, features, or the kind of parametric approach that come out of mind will be the Gaussian process that actually make use of the kernels that can represent whatever information you have, and then from which you can actually extract a parameter from those. I wonder whether those parameters may be more useful than the summary statistics.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting direction. We've been thinking of moving in directions like that. I haven't tried it yet, but yeah, thanks.
In the tutorial on music signal processing, there was a discussion of texture-like effects and the perception of combination tones and chords. Have you looked at any correlations between your work and that kind of work?
I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but I mean the word texture is used a lot in the context of music, where they typically are talking about kind of higher level types of effects. I have tried to synthesize musical textures, and it doesn't work that well. And there's a lot of interesting reasons for why I think that is. We need some more complicated statistics, essentially, for that. But music is one of the things that really doesn't work very well. And in general, things that are composed of sounds with pitch tend to not synthesize very well. So it works great on like environmental sounds and machine noise and things like that. Yeah.
Thanks, Josh.